Herb Alpert, a well-known name that has different associations for different generations. In the 1960s, trumpeter Herb Alpert headed the Tijuana Brass, playing pop music with a Mexican tinge. The group was so popular that in 1966 alone, it had 7 tunes in the top 40. The first Tijuana Brass record, The Lonely Bull, was recorded by Alpert and his partner Jerry Moss on their fledgling independent label A&M. The success of the Tijuana Brass helped build A&M into one of the most successful independent labels in the U.S. In the past few years, their artists have included Janet Jackson, Suzanne Vega, Sting, and the Go-Go's. Alpert is now the co-chair of A&M. As for Alpert's performing career, he had a number one hit in 1968 with This Guy's in Love with You. He was off the charts for the next 11 years, but in 1979, his disco instrumental Rise made it to number one. Last year, he had a big dance hit with Diamonds, which also featured singer Janet Jackson. Alpert's recording career is taking another turn with his new album, Under a Spanish Moon. It includes a suite in 3 movements for trumpet and orchestra, written for him by George Del Barrio. Of course, it's on A&M Records. Here's the opening of the suite. It's Herb Alpert from his new album, Under a Spanish Moon. Herb Alpert, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
This is a different kind of sound for you. Does it reflect a changing interest on your part?
No, not a changing interest, just a change. I like searching for new sounds and new people to work with, play with. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting, as I was listening to that, it's strange how commercial a sound can feel once you've heard it over and over. I know this kind of doesn't really make sense to think that particular record could sound great on top 40 radio, but it sounds like a hit record to me.
Well, you know, I wanted to know if you had a track from your suite that you thought of as the single.
We just heard it.
Oh, good, okay.
Well, I mean, I know that's not down the pipeline. I guess the song that Sting wrote, Fragile, would be more suited for pop radio, but I have a feeling that everyone out there is looking for something new now. There's a lot of sameness out there. We hear a lot of records that just kind of are like clones of each other. And it feels like it's time for that real left fielder, the one that's just coming way out of the blue.
Well, this is something you commissioned, right? This piece?
I commissioned George Del Barrio, a wonderful Argentinian composer. He wrote a suite for me that was part of a concert that I performed last summer with various symphony orchestras across the country.
I have a feeling that you have several different audiences and that they're each unaware of a different aspect of your work. For instance, that your Tijuana Brass audience doesn't know about your records Rise and Diamonds, and that you might develop a completely different audience with your new record, and that the people who know you from your disco and funk hits probably don't know the Tijuana Brass stuff. Have you found that to be true?
You're absolutely right on target. That's exactly what has happened. It's kind of odd in a way, because I run into people who are very familiar with the Tijuana Brass, and they say, "Hey, what, Herb, what you been doing lately? I mean, have you retired?" I said, "No, wait a minute. Haven't you heard Rise? No, what's that?" You know, so they relate to the Tijuana Brass. The folks that, you know, relate to Rise, most of those people never heard about the Tijuana Brass. And then this last album I did prior to Under a Spanish Moon, Keep Your Eye on Me, was a big urban record. So they weren't aware. Well, I guess most of those people were aware of Rise, but certainly the Tijuana Brass was not in their memory.
Is it hard to get instrumental singles on the charts now? Is it hard to get instrumentals on?
It always was hard because it's not giving people really enough information. It's easier when you say, who looks at you the way I do, and that's you can conjure up all sorts of images with that one. But when you're just blowing, you know, a horn and a melody, it's much tougher.
I want to play an excerpt of Rise, which made it to number one in 1979. And this was your first record on the charts in around 10 years, right?
Well, it was the first, let's see, since... the thing that pleased me so much about Rise, it was the first instrumental number one record I had, and also I have the distinction of having the only vocal and instrumental number one record.
This was kind of at the end of the disco era, and I was wondering if you were initially comfortable with the kind of backing that you had on this, with the production style on it.
Well, you should have heard the way it started out. It was much different. My nephew said to me, he says, Uncle, why don't you take Tijuana Taxi and Taste of Honey and some of the evergreens, Spanish Flea, and make a disco record out of them. You know, make them dance. And I said, well, I don't think it would feel right, but let me give me an idea what you have in mind. So we went into the studio, we got the musicians together, and we started playing Taste of Honey and dance version of Taste of Honey. And 10 minutes into the session, I started to get nauseous. It just didn't feel right. So we passed on that idea, and I said, do you have any other thoughts? And he said, well, I have this, you know, tape of songs that you might like. And on that tape was a song called, it was nameless, but the song Rise was on that tape. And I had this idea of recording a record that would be different than the ones that were out there at the particular moment. Most of the records were programmed between 120 and 135 beats per minute for a particular, you know, dance sequence. So I thought, wouldn't it be nice to come up with something a little bit slower that when people get tired of dancing apart, they can get together and dance? And that was the concept behind Rise. And I never thought of it as a disco dance record per se. I just thought it was, you know, just a nice record.
Let's hear it. This is Rise, featuring my guest Herb Alpert on trumpet. You know, the funny thing is in some ways, that's not very different from the kind of stuff Miles Davis was recording at the time.
Well, you know, Miles is always trying something new, too. He's always searching and picking, and I really admire his career. He's one of the trumpet players that sparked me years ago, and I really admire what he does.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Herb Alpert, and he has a new record out that's called Under a Spanish Moon and features a suite that he commissioned for trumpet and orchestra. Herb Alpert is also the A in A&M Records. How did you start listening to jazz? I figure that's what you started off listening to.
Well, no, actually, I started listening to classical music. I started playing the trumpet when I was 8, and I was with junior symphony orchestras while I was in my teens. In the Army, I picked up a record by the late, great Clifford Brown, and that was a moment that was very important for me. I was amazed by his dexterity and his ability to express himself. And from then, I started listening to Miles and Dizzy Gillespie, and I became a jazz fan. I think jazz is the real art form. It's amazing what can be created with no thought. You know, if you just use a blank canvas, close your eyes, you have your palette and as your toolkit, but for the most part, you're just responding to feelings. And it's a beautiful way to communicate.
Before you actually started your recording career, you had a very, very, very brief career as an actor. And if I have this correct, you were an extra on The Ten Commandments?
Well, I was an extra on many movies.
Oh, really?
I used to earn my living by, you know, just pretending I was playing trumpet or some type of strange instrument behind, you know, the scenes while the actual score was being played. I did play, I was on The Ten Commandments. I worked on the picture for about 3 months, actually.
Which scenes were you in?
Well, the scene where you can recognize the mole on my back is when Moses was coming down the mountain with the Ten Commandments. There was the party, they were idolizing the golden calf, and the scene actually opened on my back. And I asked Cecil B. DeMille, I turned around and said, "Do you mind if it opens on my face?" And he said, "Not this time, son."
That's really terrific. So did you not like the life of an extra?
Well, it was just a means to another end. It was just a way of earning a living. It was kindly, certainly a nice eye-opener to that area. But I studied acting with Jeff Corey for about a year. I also studied with Leonard Nimoy. And I enjoyed the experience, but I realized that I'm not a born actor. I think it's a whole other field. And just because you might look like you're able to act doesn't really give you the tools.
In the recording industry, you started out as an A&R man, which is what producers used to be called. That stands for Artists in Repertoire. And one of the first records that you produced was a cover recording of Alley Oop, which was a novelty hit in 1960. And the Hollywood Argyles had the number one version. You produced the cover that went to number 15 by Dante and Evergreen. I'll tell you the truth, I don't remember the cover version of it. I remember the hit. But would you explain what the philosophy was then behind doing covers of songs?
Well, in those days, there were a lot of records that were recorded, and other artists would either, you know, hear the song, get excited about it, and re-record, you know, the very same version. You know, Hank Ballard wrote The Twist and recorded The Twist, and a couple of months later, Chubby Checker recorded it, re-recorded the same version, and as we all know, you know, that's been a hit 3 times already. It was quite prevalent in those days. What happened was the Hollywood Argyles had this record on the West Coast, and my partner at the time, Lou Adler, and I were talking to the company we were working for in New York and asked them if they liked Alley Oop, and they had never heard of it. So that Alley Oop was already number one in Los Angeles, so we said, well, we'll send you another version of it. And the next day, we recorded it that afternoon, and the next day it was out in New York City, and it sold 230,000 records just in that area.
Oh, so they had the West Coast version, you had the East Coast version.
That was it, yeah. It's kind of a dirty thing to do, and I'd never do it again, and it's something I'm not really proud of. I don't think it's fair to do, but it was done in those days, and I didn't think twice about it because I really wasn't able to stand back and take a few beats and realize what we were doing.
Now, I want to talk to you about how you got into the studio yourself and about beginning your own recording career. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is trumpeter Herb Alpert, who has a new record called Under a Spanish Moon that features a suite that he commissioned for trumpet and orchestra. And Herb Alpert is also the A in A&M Records, which is one of the top, if not the top, independent record companies in America. We'll talk more about his recording career after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Herb Alpert is my guest. And I think most Americans were introduced to you through your work with the Tijuana Brass, which is a group that you founded and led just about throughout the 60s. The first record that you did was also the first record for A&M Records. And it was The Lonely Bull, which was a song that was written by a friend of yours under a different name, but you recorded with a Spanish tinge. How did it end up happening that way?
Well, it was it all came about after a bullfight, my very first bullfight that I saw in Tijuana in 1962, and I was taken in by the feeling of that afternoon, and I tried to translate the sight into a sound. And my friend had this melody that I loved very much. It was written, he gave me a demo of it, and he had it recorded on a celeste, and it was very ethereal. But I thought the melody was much more powerful than the way he had presented it to me. And it just fit this mood that I felt would best translate this afternoon that I experienced.
Let me just play a few seconds of that, refresh our memories, and then we'll talk some more. This is Herb Alpert's first recording as Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass, and this is The Lonely Bull. Whose idea was the sound effects at the beginning?
Well, the sound effects actually is taken from the Tijuana Bullring.
Ah.
An engineer friend of mine went down there with a tape machine and captured the spirit. I mean, talking about instrumental records, they're so hard to get play that I felt that we needed. In those days, we used to talk about where's the hook of the record. You know, when's the bridge coming? Where's that thing you can remember? You know, and I felt like we needed that hook right from the get-go. And when the Olays came in, I think the record was over. People, I know I liked it the moment I heard it.
Well, this record went to number 6 on the charts in 1962 and led to just a slew of hits for you with this Latin-tinged ensemble. And I was wondering if you ever thought about what you were tapping into in the American public to have this sound hit so big.
No, I really don't know. It was I was just choosing songs that appealed to me, and I was very... I was very much into it. I was recording with my heart. It wasn't something I wasn't turning out buttons. I wasn't trying to capitalize on the momentum. I was having fun in the studio, and when I felt good about a recording, that it would make the album, and that was my measure.
It was a very interesting time on the charts in the sense that you had we had Phil Spector records and the Beatles, coinciding with instrumental pop. Like the Tijuana Brass, do you know what I mean? It was quite a diverse mix, making it into the top 10.
Yeah, there was some really fun things happening sonically with records in the 60s, mid 60s especially. The thing that got me going was prior to the 60s, we heard the great records of Les Paul and Mary Ford, and where Les Paul used to take his guitar and overdub on top of his own sound 3, 4, 10 times. And I started doing that with the trumpet in my little garage in West Hollywood. And I arrived on this sound of the Tijuana Brass. That's the sound of my horn, multiplied.
In different channels, right?
On different channels. And also, when I played them, I had this feeling of being another person as well. Instead of trying to duplicate exactly what I was playing the first time around, I was pretending to be the second trumpet player or the third trumpet player or the fourth trumpet player, depending on how many trumpets I stacked.
Did your listeners presume that you were Latin?
I guess the public did for a while. It wasn't intended to be misleading, but I guess they did because of the name. And every now and then I tell folks that my father was born in Tijuana and moved to Russia when he was a small kid. Kind of gets a laugh.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Well, the records that you made with the Tijuana Brass really helped build A&M Records. The A was for Alpert, the M for Jerry Moss, your partner. Did you have a marketing design that worked especially well when you were first getting started? It's very hard for a fledgling label to succeed in the way that yours did.
Right. Well, we did have a concept. It was a modest one, but it was an honest one. We noticed that the records that were being put out in that particular period, most of the companies would take a hit record, and they'd surround it by 11 other sides, and they'd call it, the title would be the name of the hit record, and then you'd buy the record, and you'd, for the most part, be disappointed because you wouldn't find much else in that, in the disc, to listen to. So we decided to make every one count. You know, we'd spend as much time on cut 2 and 3 and 4 as we did on the premiere cut. So we tried to make a record that we would stop our car and go to the record shop to buy ourselves. And that was essentially the concept.
Well, early on in A&M, you had artists like Sergio Mendez and Chris Montez. And then by the late 60s, you were adding rock groups like the Procol Harum, Joe Cocker, more recently, the Go-Go's, Janet Jackson, Sting. It seems like there was a big turn in A&M from more pop-oriented music to more rock-oriented music. And I was wondering what was responsible for the shift.
Well, we just went through different roads. We had the very first rock group. Actually, it was the We Five out of San Francisco.
You Were On My Mind, their big hit.
Exactly, and that was our first number one record.
Uh-huh.
We noticed that we just had to spread our wings. We had a reputation as being a middle-of-the-road company for a long time, and then we just had to open up a few more windows, and we did, and it's just it's been growing ever since, and it's been growing gracefully and with the same dedication that Jerry and I put into it in 1962. We're fortunate in having a tremendous staff of people that reflect the same attitude that we had when we started the company.
Herb Alpert is my guest, trumpeter, and the head of A&M Records. He's the A in A&M. The M is his partner, Jerry Moss. And Herb Alpert has a new album called Under a Spanish Moon that features a suite that he commissioned for trumpet and orchestra. Could you make decisions based on your own taste once the label headed in a more rock-oriented direction?
Well, absolutely. But, as we started growing, I realized that if I was in complete control of our artist roster, we'd probably have 10 artists. So I had to give up some of that, give up part of my biases and grow with, other people's feelings as well.
Last year you had a big hit with Diamonds, which also featured singer Janet Jackson, who's one of the many members of the Jackson family. And the record was produced by her producers Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis. Now, she records for A&M. And I was wondering how this record came about. I think you asked Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis to do something for you?
Well, I jokingly asked them. We were presenting Janet with a platinum record, and we were taking pictures on the A&M lot. And I looked at Jimmy and I said, do you guys ever try and produce an instrumental artist? And they said, yeah. I mean, no, but we'd like to try it. So one thing led to another, and we got together, and it was their idea to use Janet. I was really hesitant because I didn't want it to seem like I was trying to pad my deck too hard. But in a way that record backlashed for me, because although it was a big hit record, the very first instrumental that came out was the title song "Keep Your Eye on Me." And it was really starting to, catch a lot of momentum, and it did sell rather well, but the radio land out there, they were so intrigued by Diamonds that they wouldn't get off it, and they wanted us to release Diamonds, so we had to release Diamonds on top of the momentum that we were getting with Keep Your Eye on Me. And I think Keep Your Eye on Me might have been a bigger record had Janet not participated in the record, and I'm not, complaining that she was on it. I'm just saying there was a strange backlash.
Do you think vocals frequently overshadow the instrumental part in a record?
Well, I think they just absolutely do. But of course, at that time, Janet was so hot and people couldn't get enough of her,
because right.
her Control album was going crazy, and people just wanted to hear more Janet Jackson.
Well, I'm going to play an excerpt of that record. We'll play the part where you solo on Diamonds.
Great.
Herb Alpert from his hit of last year.
That's fun. I haven't heard that in a while. That makes your head move. When I was playing the trumpet in the studio, at one point Jimmy Jam came out in the studio. He says, "Man, you got to move. You got to move." So I'm playing the horn, and while we're recording, he's actually dancing around the studio, giving me all the body language.
Well, it's funny, you're recording with a generation much younger than you are.
Well, not really. I mean, music is music. I think Sam Cooke taught me the greatest lesson of all. He said, look it, man, it either makes it or it don't. Nobody cares how old you are, you know, what type of trumpet you're using, you know, how long you've practiced, what echo chamber, what engine. It's not important. It either works or it doesn't, and that's the measure.
Let me ask you a question about A&M. You're still an independent record company, although you're distributed by RCA now. Have there been offers to buy you up, but offers by bigger companies or conglomerates? And what's the importance to you of remaining an independent company?
Oh, we've had offers through the years, and it's, you know, we bat them off. Well, we like to be independent because we're able to make our own decisions. I can't see being in a room filled with 30 people and taking a vote on whether a record should be released or not. Or, you know, it just makes it so much nicer for us to conduct our business the way we see fit.
How often do you report to the office?
Well, I don't report in that sense. I just, you know, do what feels right for me, because I'm in that position now.
Do you keep all of your records in print?
What do you mean by that?
All of the Tijuana Brass records and all the records under your name. Do you keep them in print since they're on your label?
No, there are some cutouts. There are some records that didn't do well. But for the most part, most are available. Most of the Tijuana Brass records are available.
Okay. Well, listen.
And especially now with CD. You know, CD's been
right.
A great windfall for the record industry. So a lot of, you know, records have been resurrected because of CDs.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us a little bit about your life and your music. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Terry.
My guest has been trumpeter Herb Alpert, who's also the head of A&M Records. And his own new record is called Under a Spanish Moon, and it features a suite he commissioned for trumpet and orchestra. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.